Good morning. Before I share with you some thoughts regarding Beethoven's Daiku, and we'll talk about what Daiku means in a moment, I want to take this opportunity to thank some very special people. First and foremost, I guess, would be Carrie Bastian. She's been a saint to work with. We rehearsed yesterday, and it's an absolute joy to come into a situation and be able to collaborate with such a wonderful musician. So you're blessed to have Carrie here. Likewise, David Ward. We've communicated many times via email. What would we do without email? And he likewise has been, I'll overuse this word, but he's been a saint also. So thank you, David. That very eloquent expression from a more lengthy expression by Leonard Bernstein that's included in your program. And I do want to refer you to the insert, by the way, because at some point I think you'll find it helpful to make a reference there. But I very much appreciate the eloquent expression of an excerpt from the Bernstein commentary by Mr. Alan Schwartzman. So thank you, Alan, very much. And I would be terribly remiss if I didn't recognize my own brother, Bob, and his efforts in ensuring that his half of the responsive reading group performed as well as he did. And I would be doubly remiss if I left out your minister. So it's an absolute joy to be here. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I gave this presentation back in May in our UUTC, which stands for Unitarian Universalists of Transylvania County. And for better or for worse, sent a copy to my brother Bob, and he got this idea somehow that maybe I should inflict it on you. So he went before the worship committee, and hence here I am this morning. If you find anything of value or interest in what I share with you, make sure you thank my brother Bob. Conversely, if you find little or no value of interest, make sure, again, you direct your comments to my brother Bob. Beethoven's Daiku Unbound. The late Dean of American Music, Aaron Copland, once remarked that, quote, "If a literary man puts together two words about music, one of them will be wrong." Presuming to possess some, though not a great amount of literacy, I therefore admonish you not to ascribe too much credibility to what I have to share with you this morning. On May 7, 1824, Ludwig van Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the Ode to Joy Symphony, received its premiere in Vienna, Austria. The audience responded to this first-of-its-kind choral symphony. The audience response was allegedly loud and enthusiastic. However, as Unitarian minister and author Robert Fulghum reminds us in an essay on the Ninth Symphony, quote, "He, Beethoven, never really heard it. He just thought it." Fulghum asserts furthermore that Beethoven defied his fate with jubilation. Defied his fate? Total deafness by the age of 48. The subsequent completion of his final symphony, the Monumental Ninth, 6 years later, is evidence not only of his prodigious creative fortitude, but also his determination to, in his words, "seize fate by the throat. It shall certainly not bend and crush me completely." The words that come to my mind are from Friedrich Nietzsche, relative to that statement by Beethoven. Nietzsche, later in the century, remarked, "He who has a why to live for can bear almost any how." Today, this musical manifestation of egalitarian principles is the composition of choice for political and cultural celebrations throughout the world. For example, Christmas 1989, some of you may recall this. Leonard Bernstein conducted a version of the Ninth with Freiheit, freedom, replacing Freude, joy, to celebrate the fall of the Berlin Wall. At the time, Bernstein commented, quote, "Beethoven would have given us his blessing in this heaven-sent moment." 1998, Winter Olympics in Nagano, Japan. Sergio Ozawa appeared in what may have been the largest electronic simulation of a concert hall ever imagined. He conducted six choirs that were located in New York, Berlin, Cape Town, Sydney, Beijing, and Nagano, six cities on five continents, in a televised simulcast in which all of them sang the Ode to Joy electronically synchronized to overcome time differences. Amazing feat, the world we live in. 1985, you probably know that the European Union chose Beethoven's music as their EU anthem. And something close to my heart, since I lived in Connecticut for years and not far from New York City, there's the station of the New York Times, WQXR, and every year they have a classical countdown. 25 years ago, I checked in to see what the classical countdown was suggesting as to listeners' favorite works. And 25 years ago, it was Beethoven's ninth as number one. Can you guess what was number two? Beethoven's fifth. I checked it just this past year. Guess what? Beethoven ninth is still at the top, and the fifth is number two. What is there about this music? This morning, I'd like to explore with you some of the elements that account for the lasting appeal, albeit inspiration, of this immortal composition. To begin, however, perhaps a word of explanation is in order regarding the title of this presentation, Beethoven's Daiku Unbound. In Japan, massed choral groups and orchestras come together in December of each year, and they give performances of Daiku. Daiku, to them, stands for the Big Nine, namely Beethoven's Last Symphony. The Big Nine Unbound? Well, just as in the world of baseball with its padded bases, nine innings, and sometimes tied score, this music includes string basses, or simply basses. It is Beethoven's ninth, and it includes a musical score. Consider the following story. A number of years ago, the Seattle Symphony was doing Beethoven's ninth under the baton of Milton Katems. At this point, you must understand two things. First, there's a long segment in this symphony where the bass violins don't have a thing to do, not a single note for page after page. Secondly, there used to be a tavern called Desi's 400 right across the street from the Seattle Opera House, rather favored by the local musicians. It had been decided that during the performance, after the bass players had played their parts in the opening of the ninth, they would quietly lay down their instruments, leave the stage, and rather than sit on their stools for the next 20 minutes. Well, once they got backstage, someone suggested they trot across the street and quaff a few brews. After they had downed the first couple rounds, one said, "Shouldn't we be getting back? It'd be awfully embarrassing if we were late." Another, presumably the one who suggested this excursion in the first place, replied, "Oh, I anticipated we could use a little more time, so I tied a string around the last pages of the conductor's score." There it is. When he gets down to that point, Milton's going to have to slow the tempo way down while he waves the baton with one hand and fumbles with a string with the other. So they had another round and finally returned to the opera house a little tipsy by now. However, as they came back on stage, one look at their conductor's face told them that they were in serious trouble. Katems was furious, and why not? After all, it's the bottom of the ninth, the score was tied, and the bases were loaded. Before we untie the score and explore the bottom or finale of the ninth, I want to share a few assessments of Beethoven's Daiku and briefly review pre-ninth symphony activity. These are some of the assessments of the ninth. One is from a French dramatist and essayist by the name of Romain Rolland. And he suggests that this work, the ninth, preaches the kingdom of God on earth, established by the brotherhood of man in reason and joy. 19th century conductor by the name of Louis Spohr had quite a different take on this. He found the finale of the ninth, quote, "monstrous, tasteless, and in its handling of Schiller's Ode to Joy, so trivial that I cannot comprehend how such a genius as Beethoven could have written it, unquote. Johannes Brahms is interesting. His quote is, "I will never finish a symphony. You have no idea how it affects one's spirits to hear continually the marching of a giant behind him." Boston Music Record, 1899, quote, "Is not the worship paid to symphony mere fetishness or fetishism? Oh, the unspeakable cheapness of the chief tune, Freude, Freude. Do you believe way down in the bottom of your heart that if this music had been written by Mr. John L. Tarbox, now living in Sandown, New Hampshire, any conductor here or in Europe could be persuaded to put it in rehearsal?" And finally, Leonard Bernstein, who, by the way, back in the 80s recorded all 9 symphonies with a Vienna symphony with whom he had a very special love affair. And he provided wonderful commentary, including what's included in your the insert in the program, on the 9th. And Bernstein, in that commentary, includes the words, "We cannot listen to the 9th symphony without emerging from it changed, enriched, encouraged. This music speaks a universality of thought, of human brotherhood, freedom, and love." Regarding pre-9th symphonic activity, as you know, he wrote 8 symphonies before this, and none of us has been able to escape, I think, the other widely popular Beethoven symphony, the 5th, with its unforgettable 3 shorts and a long rhythmic motive. Try to escape that. The other is the opening of his Eroica symphony, number 3, 2 very abrupt chords. I like to refer to those 2 instances, by the way, as sonic shock and awe. And in their day, they must have been, because no one before Beethoven had the courage or the audacity or whatever else to write an opening of a symphony like that. The greatly expanded form of the 3rd, by the way, it was 700 measures just for the first movement of the 3rd. That movement in itself was the length of symphonies by Mozart and Haydn prior, just that one movement, if you will. And then, of course, we all know of the 6th symphony, the Pastorale, where he expanded to a 5th movement even, and it's programmatic and reflects a lot of Beethoven's profound love of nature, as you know. That same 4-hour program in 1808 that witnessed the premiere of both the 5th and 6th symphonies also included a work, Opus 80, Fantasy for Piano, Chorus, and Orchestra, with, not surprisingly, Beethoven at the piano, and a musical setting of a poem in praise of harmony of life, art, and music attributed to Christian Kufner. This work anticipates in striking ways the finale of the 9th, particularly with respect to the similar thematic material and variation technique utilized by Beethoven. David, we had a very brief rehearsal yesterday, and so far he's doing a masterful job. With respect to Beethoven the person, the 15-year span separating that work and the 9th symphony witnessed the progressive loss of hearing. Also his frequent withdrawal from society and a lengthy, successful battle for the custody of his nephew, Carl. So he had a lot of challenging personal things going on after he wrote that work, prior to writing the 9th, of course. Despite, or perhaps because of his misfortune, he resolved to, as stated above, seize fate by the throat and fulfill a creative desire first kindled many years earlier in the 1790s. He, at that time, became aware of Schiller's Ode to Joy poem. And the resultant 9th symphony represents, as you all know, a radically new creation, where we add soloist choral voices into the symphonic genre for the very first time that we know of in history. Time doesn't permit me to provide an elaborate analysis of this monumental composition. However, I would like to explore with you a few of the elements in the finale that may account for the undeniable universality and immortality of the work. The finale of the ninth begins in dramatic fashion with a fortissimo passage scored for brass and winds plus timpani without strings. And we're going to hear this now, and I will do some... fury of that opening again, as you will hear. First of all, try out the theme from the first movement of the symphony. And after he presents just this little quote that you're hearing now, he decides, oh no, that won't do. Something more pleasant for a melody. This is actually documented in his sketchbooks. The rare times, instead of just writing music, there he's writing prose. So then he said, well, how about the theme from the second movement? You're going to hear next from the scherzo. Maybe I can pull from that and come up with an ode to joy melody. It's coming up here momentarily. Second movement theme, just a trace. His comment is that's no better, merely rather more cheerful. So now we come to that the adagio. He quotes from the third movement now, and I'll share his comment after you hear this. Here's the opening of the adagio. That's also too tender. I must find something more rousing, like the, I'll sing you something myself. And then he sings, which you hear in anticipation of the joy. The wind instruments will introduce just a taste of the Ode to Joy melody right here. His comment at this point is, that will do. Now I have found a way to express joy. We're at the point now where that lovely Ode to Joy theme is going to be introduced, and rather than take you through the entire set of variations, what I'm going to have you listen to next is the second variation and third variation on the Ode to Joy theme. So if we would, David, please. This is a very typical Beethoven technique when it comes to theme and variation, presented initially in the low voices and simply shifted up, and now it's up in the first violins. And then also, so typical of Beethoven as he realizes, I guess we want one really majestic statement. Watch how it builds in the full orchestra now and just pulls out all the stops. I think he was thinking he'd work it. It's coming up. Thank you. As a horn player, we love those fortissimo passages because the conductor isn't doing this to us. He actually says more. You know? So, according to Beethoven's friend, Anton Schindler, finding a way of introducing Schiller's ode to joy represented a very formidable challenge, as I mentioned before. After considerable struggle with this task, Beethoven entered the room one day and shouted to Schindler, "I've got it. I just got it." He showed Schindler a sketchbook with the words, "Let us sing the ode of the immortal Schiller." Beethoven purportedly spent a great deal of time rewriting the part until it had reached the form recognizable today. O Freude, nicht diese Töne. O friends, not these tones. Beethoven set his own words to music, scoring it for bass solo in the form of a recitative that represents the earlier cello bass recitative. I would direct your attention to that program insert now, because we're actually going to get to some of the text and deal with a few excerpts from the section where the voices come into play. So the side that has the translation. Schiller's poem provides the narrative for that aspect of the ninth that biographer Lewis Lockwood, in his book Beethoven, the Music and the Life, in a chapter titled The Celestial and the Human, he refers to its religious dimension. According to Lockwood, Schiller's poem is divided into two forms of imagery, one portraying a circle of friends praising joy as a spiritual and moral condition, and the other widening the poet's outreach in the choruses to embrace all humanity. Lockwood furthermore suggests that Beethoven's choice of poetic material shows him laying stress on the balance between the two basic topics in the text, secular and religious. Part one, the secular image. Part two, the religious image. Part three, unification of the two worlds of feeling, the communal and the religious. Two disparate themes are combined in a double fugue. Let's move ahead. Alone. Now here's the fourth variation. Bass, and you'll hear Thank you, David. So it's now become a choral symphony, if you will. And this section culminates with a declamatory setting that has the text, as you see there, translates, and the cherub stands before God. And what follows then is a little Turkish march, if you will. So we'll go with that now. Push those dials up, because it's a very quiet Turkish march as it starts. Turkish bands were very popular at this time. Beethoven decided, let's bring in some cymbals, triangle, bass drum, and just have some fun with the Ode to Joy theme. in a new key, B flat major. This is just fun stuff now, before the tenor solos come in. There was a lighter side to it. There's an extended fugal part for the orchestra after the tenor comes in, and you see the text there for the tenor soloist. And then he decides it's time to bring back the opening melody in a very full-fledged form for full chorus and orchestra. Excuse for coming in on the wrong note. The horns are playing octaves F sharps, and that's their pitch. If they miss this one, well. Beethoven now decides it's time to introduce a new theme, and this clearly, I think, is designed to enhance Schiller's affection for the whole world. And you can see that on the page where it says, "Be embraced, millions, this kiss for the whole world." In my notes that we're reaching a point where we have sopranos up in the upper stratosphere for the text Beyond the Stars, and clearly most sopranos would agree with me that that's kind of the bane of their existence, to have to sing parts like this, but it's pretty incredible what happens here. And then he writes something that's absolutely exquisite, and that's a double fugue where he takes the Ode to Joy theme and the second theme and combines them in a massive double fugue.
Thank you.
as you may know, if you happen to experience the 1989 performance that took place at the Berlin Wall, Bernstein came up with a brilliant approach to this. He simply brought in several scores of children's voices. He just brought in a whole children's choir, if you will, and let them scream away on those high notes along with the soprano. So I'm sure that the adult sopranos just blessed Bernstein for that. The final section begins and ends with Schiller's opening line, "Joy, beautiful spark of God's." Beethoven interrupts the Semper Più Allegro, that is the always a little faster passages, several times with the fleeting adagio, very slow sections. And then there's this flurry of orchestral sounds that reflect again how this genius defied his fate with jubilation, and the work then comes to an end. So this final section. This is the Semper Pew at the 1824 premiere, after the last notes were sounded, Beethoven was seen on stage still conducting. It's a very kind gesture on the part of the ensemble that performed that premiere, because they did have a conductor who had the blessing of hearing, but they decided to have the grandmaster on stage also with a score off to the side conducting. So there he was, still conducting at the end. And a teenage alto soloist by the name of Carolyn Unger walked over, turned Beethoven around so that he could accept the audience's cheers and applause, which, of course, he could not hear. The audience acclaimed him through standing ovations five times. There supposedly were handkerchiefs in the air, hats, and raised hands so that Beethoven could at least see the ovation gestures. In closing, on a personal note, I've had the opportunity to perform this work a few times with professional orchestras during my 30-plus years in the state of Connecticut. At the end of each performance, I cherished the pre-applause silence, which was usually brief, but there was this brief silence, as a time to briefly reflect on my feelings of sincere gratitude to Beethoven for this musical gift. Gratitude shared by millions of listeners and performers throughout the 185-year history of this immortal music. During those poignant moments of silence, I was reminded also that the composer of this inspiring work was, in the words of George Eliot, on the other side of silence. Perhaps the Reverend Robert Fulghum said it best in his essay on Beethoven's Ninth with these words. This essay, by the way, is included in Everything I Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. He included this essay on Beethoven's Ninth. These are Fulghum's words. "I find within Beethoven's music an irresistible affirmation. In deep spiritual winter, I find inside myself the sun of summer. Someday, some incredible December night, when I am very rich, I'm going to, and he sold several bestsellers, so I think he's at that point now where he could do this. I'm going to rent me a grand hall and a great choir and a mighty symphony orchestra and stand on the podium and conduct the ninth. And I will personally play the kettle drum part all the way through to the glorious end while simultaneously singing along at the very top of my lungs. And in the awesome silence that follows, I will bless all the gods that be for Ludwig van Beethoven, for his ninth and his light. In just 15 short years from now, the world will celebrate the bicentennial of the birth of the music that, more than any other composition, as noted by Leonard Bernstein, speaks a universality of thought, of human brotherhood, freedom, and love. During the years leading up to that auspicious year of celebration, 2024, one can rest assured that the inspiring transcendence enjoyed by millions of people throughout the history of the Ode to Joy Symphony, Beethoven's Die Kuh, will be experienced abundantly throughout the world. Rather than end on too profound of a note, I have a postscript that reads, a symphony spokesperson has informed me that the bass players unwillingly furloughed from the Seattle Symphony have been reinstated. Thank you very much.